If it wasn't hard enough to battle one of the great courses in our country in search of a second U.S. Open title, Wyndham Clark had to endure the relentless vitriol from a crowd that wanted to see anyone else but him win. Folks, golf is so much better than what transpired over the weekend at Shinnecock Hills Golf Club on Long Island. Kelly Elbin welcoming you to our recap of the 126th United States Open Golf Championship. And along with our executive producer, Jenna Self, we will be joined shortly by Mark Cannizzaro, who covered his 35th United States Open at Shinnecock for the New York Post. Mark was on the front line, so to speak, as he heard the cheers for bad shots by Clark, and frankly, at times, virtual silence for good ones. And Mark absolutely tells it like it is, like it was. Look, by nature, I'm a pretty upbeat and positive guy, and I am not exactly a huge fan of Wyndham Clark. Come on out. The guy has apologized over and over for bashing in the lockers last year at the U.S. Open at Oakmont Country Club. He paid his fare, his bill to the club. He did what he was asked to do with anger management classes. And yet, he was just subject to such harsh comments from the crowd at Shinnecock time and again. And all he did was go out and make, particularly on Saturday, those fantastic par-saving putts, and enough on Sunday so that six-shot lead going into the final round didn't evaporate altogether, and he held on to win by one stroke. And this is exactly what he said in his press conference afterward.
Man, they definitely didn't want me to win. Pretty rare in an open championship or a major to have fans kind of boo against your shots or cheer for bad shots. That was tough. But I also sometimes being the underdog is nice. I was in 23, and I kind of did the same thing. Anytime someone said something negative to me, I replaced it with something positive. And some of it's self-deserved. I kind of brought it on myself. But I also get it too. I mean, Scotty was going for the career Grand Slam, and that hasn't happened very often. So, it was tough, but I'm proud of myself that I battled through. I mean, things really could have gotten away from me, and I stood tough. And, yeah, I would have liked to win by more, but as long as you win, it doesn't matter.
And this should be a celebration. It should be not a coronation necessarily, but look, the two U.S. Opens that Wyndham Clark has won, he held off Rory McIlroy at L.A. Country Club in 2023. As he mentioned, he held off Scottie Scheffler. And frankly, Scotty didn't play particularly well. Scheffler's been off. He just has been. It was his 30th birthday. He was chasing history, trying to become the seventh to win all four of the major championships in his career. He just didn't play well enough. Sam Burns, boy, super close to that putt goes in on 18 to possibly force it a tie. But Sam's played well in the last two U.S. Opens, had a lousy break with the rule last year when he clearly was in standing water at Oakmont. Nonetheless, kudos to him for playing well. Tom Kim, good to see him get a taste of the top of the list at a U.S. Open at a major championship. Again, it should be fun. It should be happy stuff, but it wasn't. And Scottie Scheffler pretty much said the same thing.
I mean, the crowd was tough today. I mean, New Yorkers, they're tough people. There was a good turnout from the fans. You know, you like seeing the fans cheer for you. I think sometimes it can get a little too much when, you know, balls are kind of going off greens and you start hearing cheers. That felt a bit much to me. But at the end of the day, you know, I can't control fan behavior. It's being in the arena is not for everybody. You know, there's been crowds that have been for me in my career. There's been crowds that have been significantly against me in my career. You know, I think of Port Rush was a scenario for me where, you know, Rory's in his hometown, or not his hometown, he's in Ireland and not far from where he grew up. And, you know, crowds can be tough, and being in the arena is not for everybody. And, you know, I think it shows a lot about Wyndham, how he handled not only this golf course, but I think the crowd today as well, and is a, you know, well-deserving champion.
Classy comments from Scottie Scheffler, and he'll get that that U.S. Open Championship at some point down the road and become the seventh to win all four major championships. Congratulations to Wyndham Clark. And maybe Wyndham Clark, as we go through time and this kind of bad spot fades away at what happened, he becomes, if not a fan favorite, at least more respected than he was over the 4 days of the U.S. Open. Okay, big news before we get to Mark Cannizzaro. As we're recording this on Tuesday, June 23rd, the PGA Tour has come out with a major overhaul to its competitive schedule. So starting in 2028 is a two-track system. There's been some talk about the potential for that. Well, now it's going to happen. The Championship Series will feature up to 24 events, including 16 signature events, the Players' Championship, the four major championships, and season-ending events such as the President's Cup and the Ryder Cup. Each of those will be 120 players, except for the team events. It'll be 120 players, $20 million purses, and the top 90 out of those 120 will keep their tour privileges for the championship series for the following year. Then the secondary series, the Challenger Series, will be 20 events, 144 players per event, $4 million per event. They'll run concurrently. There will be some weeks where you'll have a championship series event and a challenger series event. But the big thing as part of this is if you win twice on the challenger series, you automatically advance to the championship series. If you are among the top 20 in points on the challenge series at the end of the year, you are elevated to the championship series for the following season. And there's a relegation there. I don't know that that Brian Rolapp, who, by the way, was named the new commissioner of the PGA Tour, in addition to the CEO title that he holds. I didn't see that how many might be relegated, but certainly there would be at least 30 who wouldn't. If you have 120 at the start and only 90 make it, that would be 30 who would be relegated. So it's Tiger Woods back from his time away from the game, introduced Brian. Tiger was a big part of the committee that put this together. The response initially among players has been very good. There's a fall series portion of that that incorporates a number of international events and the DP World Tour. But starting in 2028, the PGA Tour will look very, very different than it has looked for quite some time. Let's hope it's the right thing. Golf is in a good spot, and let's hope that the decisions that Brian Rolapp and those on the committee, the future competitions committee for the PGA Tour, have put something in place that will have it will be good for the game for many, many years. Okay, Mark Cannizzaro. I've known Mark for a number of years from his work with the New York Post. Outstanding writer. Mark also covered the New York Jets for a number of years. He talks about that. He played both soccer and tennis at Ithaca College. He talks a little bit about that. It's a really fun interview from a guy who is really into what he does as a profession. He just left this morning to go out to Los Angeles to cover the U.S. Men's soccer team at the World Cup. So we wish Mark all the best and know he's going to do a great job there. And then he'll be on to the Open Championship at Royal Birkdale in July. All right. Remember now, please subscribe and like Musings on Golf on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to your favorite podcast, Musings on Golf being your number one podcast, of course. And now, right after we hear from our friends at William & Harry Golf and the Friars Golf Club, you'll hear from Mark Cannizzaro of the New York Post as we recap the 2026 U.S. Open. This Father's Day, give Dad something he'll carry for years to come. The William & Harry Whole Grain Calfskin Leather Weekender Duffel is crafted for golf trips, weekend escapes, private club weekends, business travel, and elevated everyday carry. With timeless styling and premium craftsmanship, the supple full-grain calfskin leather is more than a travel bag. It's a statement piece for the modern gentleman. structured, refined, and designed to travel beautifully, each Weekender also includes a protective dust bag for the ultimate luxury experience. Now for Father's Day, the leather Weekender duffel is available for only $385. Visit WilliamAndHarry.com today and give Dad a gift that travels as well as he does. Is your golf life stuck in a bunker of country club hassles? Tired of the wait lists and the six-figure initiation fees? Well, at the Friars Golf Club, we take care of all of the hard work, planning exclusive trips and unforgettable rounds on top-rated courses, so all you have to do is show up, have fun, and make lifelong friendships on the first tee, the 19th hole, and far beyond. Our terrific 2026 lineup includes international destinations like Dubai and Scandinavia, plus top domestic resorts such as Sand Valley and Black Desert, and access to some great private clubs. Join the Friars Golf Club today. Email us at info@thefriars.com, the word musings in the subject line, to receive a $500 trip credit when you join. We invite you to stop dreaming and start living the ultimate golf experience with the Friars Golf Club. From the depths of destruction he left in his wake last year at Oakmont to the heights of once again hoisting the U.S. Open trophy in triumph at Shinnecock Hills, man, oh man, it has been a roller coaster ride of redemption for Wyndham Clark, who held off and hung on to capture his second National Open title in 4 years, winning the 126th U.S. Open on Sunday on Long Island. And here to provide his perspective on Wyndham's win and the week at one of the shrines of the game is our special guest, Mark Cannizzaro, a senior sports writer and the longtime golf writer for the New York Post, who just covered his 35th U.S. Open. Hey, Mark, so happy to have you join us. Welcome. Hey, Mark, look, it was not by any means a popular victory, an unusual victory, particularly for an American on U.S. soil. But you have to hand it to Wyndham Clark, don't you, in terms of showing his mettle against so many situations against him.
100%, Kelly. I mean, this was, you know, I was walking, around with Wyndham and Scotty in the final pairing there. And listen, you knew that the crowd was going to be behind Scotty because they want to see history. And, you know, the other element to that is the fact that Wyndham brought, you know, a massive lead into the day, you know, a seemingly insurmountable 6-shot lead. For anybody, you know, that there was a handful of one unders that, you know, maybe needed a miracle round. And I think there's, you know, like you do at tennis matches, you know, if, you know, people want to see a third set or a fifth set or whatever, right? So I think certainly the crowd wanted, you know, some drama, as, you know, as we all did as journalists, you know, we wanted something to write. But I thought it went way over the top. It just, you know, I get it. You know, Wyndham had the incident smashing the locker at Oakmont, which was, you know, obviously, you know, kind of a out of body, you know, lost his composure moment. And he's apologized for it repeatedly. I just thought some of the comments I heard out of the crowds. I was standing on the fourth tee and the crowd was serenading Scotty, you know, happy birthday, because it was his 30th yesterday. Father's Day, happy Father's Day. There were a few hook 'em Scotties, you know, for his, you know, his Texas connection. And, you know, then shortly right after that, Wyndham's, you know, setting up to hit his tee shot on four, and some idiot in the crowd yells, you know, "Don't choke, Wyndham." And fortunately, the guy was, you know, was sent off pretty quickly by security and booted from the place. But the one thing is weird, you know, I mean, I just, you know, we're not too far off from covering the Ryder Cup, you know, on Long Island at Bethpage, where obviously there was some over the top behavior there. I felt like this to me was so much more egregious than the Ryder Cup, because the Ryder Cup's a team event. The booing is because, you know, the patriotic U.S. fans want the U.S. to beat Europe. We all get that. This to me was insidious when you're literally willing a guy's ball to go to a bunker, you know, applauding a bad shot that goes into the fescue, you know, just overtly rooting against the guy, which is not really in the spirit of golf. I'm not trying to be corny here or whatever, but, you know, we've all been around the game for a long time. That's not really how it goes. That's not how it works. That's not how people operate. You can root for the guy that you want to root for, but you don't necessarily root against the other person. And that really, that happened in spades, I thought, yesterday. And it was pretty, there was some vicious stuff out there. So bad that that literally that Wyndham's his mental coach, Julie Elion, who I've known for a number of years, I was chatting with her afterwards at the green, you know, after it was all over. She literally left the golf course at the eighth hole and went inside of the clubhouse because she was so appalled at the stuff she was hearing and was feeling very defensive and really probably feeling like she wanted to lash out at those people. So, yeah, it was all told, the mental toughness that Wyndham showed to get through that day is remarkable. Maybe some of the best I've ever seen, because there were more forces against him other than just a very difficult course or some guys charging at him. You know, he had a force against him that doesn't usually, you know, rear its head in golf. And that was, you know, a lot of people in the galleries that were, you know, I mean, just acted like idiots.
Why do you think the vitriol was so over the top, as you said?
You know, I don't, that's a good question. I clearly everybody wanted Scotty because they wanted to see history. So that's a selfish pull right there for them, which is fine. But to go over the top, I just don't know. I mean, Wyndham is not a non-likable guy. You know, I mean, I've got one of my dearest friends is a member at Whisper Rock, where Wyndham belongs and plays a lot and, you know, lives out that way. And it's hard to find a lot of guys that have bad things to say about Wyndham out there. You know, I just I don't know. I mean, are people still ticked off at him for smashing the lockers at Oakmont? I mean, you know, it's not like any of us haven't done idiotic things in our lives, but, you know, people forget about that because, of course, they all think they're, you know, they never done anything wrong. But I, you know, I don't know. I mean, this just it did seem to be more than just rooting for Scotty to win, you know, the Grand Slam. I don't know. It just was, you know. Listen, I mean, I'm not going to make excuses for people. It's late in the day. People are pounding drinks and beers, whatever. That it's just, I mean, but that happens at every golf tournament. And this kind of stuff does not take place at any golf tournament I've ever seen.
You mentioned that Julie Elion, who's been with him as his sports psychologist since 2022. I was struck just seeing her on the practice range, Mark, before he went out and played. You know, I've had Dr. Bob Rotella on our show and the very famous sports psychologist, but I can't remember ever having seen Dr. Rotella on the range with a player. It's usually on a phone call, that kind of thing, you know, the night before or the day of. But she's part of it. And what if you could elaborate a little bit, because in your story today that you posted last night, talked about his dad, and it's really kind of a team effort, right? It's a singular game, but he's got quite the team behind him.
No question about it. I mean, Kelly, you've been around the game for a long time and you know, around these, and as Janice has, I mean, it's just, you know, and the more modern athlete now, almost every, whether it's tennis, you know, the individual sports, whether it's tennis, golf, whatever, they're always thanking their team. You know, there's always emotional thank yous to the team after Wimbledon or U.S. Open tennis or French Open, which we just got through in tennis. And that happens in golf, too. I mean, there's a lot, you know, there's a lot more people around the athletes now than there used to be. Now there's nutritionists and the putting coach and the swing coach and, you know, now the mental coach and the, you know, obviously the caddy, all those kind of things, the agent. So, you know, I kind of pointed out in my column, you know, today for the New York Post, I kind of shine some light on each one of these people and what they've done for him. And, you know, in this run of his, you know, which includes the 2023 U.S. Open, Julia, just kind of a short time prior to him winning that U.S. Open, had just joined him. She actually, interestingly, was joined him at the suggestion and somewhat urge of Wyndham's previous caddy, John Ellis, who was a really, really good friend of his, who was with him for a decade. And they parted ways just literally a couple few months ago because Wyndham was in a bad place with his game. And as you know, that's what players do, you know, when they're not, you know, so not that I'm being a little facetious there, because sometimes the player thinks it is somebody else's fault. Wyndham wanted to end the caddy relationship because he wanted to retain the friendship, you know, with Ellis. But Ellis, Julie told me, was really the catalyst for getting the two of them together, you know, making the suggestion and putting, you know, putting Wyndham on the phone with her because he really felt like she would help him. And if you saw him yesterday, he actually thanked John Ellis, you know, who's not even caddying for him anymore, you know, for getting him to the place he's at now, because certainly he caddied for him when he won his first major championship. But the thing with the Julie thing is, I just think it's a feel thing for the players. Like, Rotella has his own way of doing things. I'm certain that Julie being out on the range, you know, was just kind of a few last minute reassurances of the things they had spoken about the night before. Julie told me when I spoke to her afterwards, you know, on the 18th yesterday, that they had had a conversation on Saturday night over the phone and kind of formulated a game plan. The game plan was essentially to, you know, obviously block it out, because you're going to hear, you know, they knew they were going to hear negative things from the crowd. They knew the crowd was going to be rooting for Scotty. But some of the things they came up with Wyndham and his current new caddy, Big Wave Dave, when people were yelling nasty stuff to him, he would say to, you know, to Dave, like, "Hey, there's some other people that love me also," you know, just kind of turn it into a goof, you know. You know, so that, you know, it was, you know, I'm sure Julie was probably just, you know, going over and reiterating those last few minute affirmations of the things they spoke about the day before. Cause yeah, you're right. I mean, the mental coach is not usually on the range. That's usually the swing coach out there. Right. So, but all of these guys, these people had a little piece in, you know, his success this week and also kind of digging him out. He talked about the dark place that he was in, you know, after Blunt, you know, he knew he had shattered his reputation. You know, he knew he wasn't playing good golf. You know, all of that stuff was going away and he was watching it go away and he knew he had to rehabilitate himself. And there were a lot of people that helped him do that. And, you know, a lot of the people we just spoke about, you know, his agent is a guy named Rob Muji, who, interestingly enough, as you know, I cover football here in New York. Rob's brother Darren is a Jets general manager, who actually was out on 18. In fact, I was scurrying back to the media tent to write my story, I bumped into Darren. He was with his two young kids. He had come out for the day to watch. They all have a hand in it, and Wyndham did reference that in his press conference last night, and mentioned a lot of those people by name. So, you know, it's funny. You kind of look, you know. You know, the era that I first met you, Carly, was the Tiger Woods era. You know, that's right. I knew you when you were at the PGA, you know, PGA of America. And, yeah. You know, if anything, Tiger was the one guy that seemed like he was doing it alone because he was such a big presence and all that, you know.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, there's just a lot of stuff that goes into these guys, the weeks. And nowadays, like I said, it's much more commonplace where got people, you know, these players have a lot of people around them. Sometimes, you know, I'm a little cynical. I'm like, do you really need that many people around you? Or
yeah,
do you need
right, six sure.
people around you at the range? You know, those kind of things. But, you know, I think, you know, in Wyndham's case, you know, every single person in his group had a little hand in what took place yesterday.
Yeah. A great summary there, Mark. And also this, you know, he didn't come out in blue here. Yes. He had, you know, had been in a dark place. The fact is he won in Texas not too long ago. So he started to prove to himself, Mark Cannizzaro, that he couldn't win again at a very high level.
He did. And getting back to that team, you know, he had a new coach that he brought in, the director of golf at Cherry Hills. And he had been going without a swing coach, which is kind of unorthodox on the tour. You know,
very much
what we were just speaking about. Usually guys have, you know, chipping coaches, putting coaches, swing coaches. And, so, you know, he had brought this coach aboard not long ago. And, you know, I think that, you know, and I mean, Wyndham's always been a really, really serious ball striker. And I think he maybe lost a little bit of that mojo and, you know, the new coach has brought him back to those levels again. I'm happy, listen, the more the day went on, as a sports writer, I was rooting for Scotty yesterday, you know, quietly, because I want to cover history and, you know, covering Rory's, you know, Grand Slam in '05 over at Augusta, and you know I was there when Tiger completed his Grand Slam, covered that. So you know I wanted to see Scotty at least make a legitimate run at that. I wasn't rooting against, you know, I don't root really, but you know, because I always have liked Wyndham, but you know, I mean, I was interested as a story writer to, you know, to write Scotty. And you know, by the way, had he won yesterday and won the Grand Slam, he would have been overcoming a 6-shot deficit on a Sunday at Shinnecock, which would have added to the lore. So, you know, but I as the day wore on, I turned to a colleague as I was out listening to these idiots and watching the way Wyndham was handling it. I found myself, you know, internally really rooting for him. And I thought him winning was the best story yesterday. Even better than Scotty winning the Grand Slam, because I think Scotty's going to win the career Grand Slam at some point. It's just a matter of time, and this was only the first go-around. And he, quite frankly, and I know we're talking about it a little later on the podcast, but Scotty just didn't have his A game this week. Anyway,
go ahead and elaborate on that a little bit now, if you would. And he seems to have been a little bit off, if you will, this year, just in terms of not matching the number of victories, Mark, that he had last year. But frankly, in watching him over the last two rounds, other than the chip shot on what, 16?
14, March, Saturday.
13, sorry. He didn't really make any putts of any consequence.
No. His putter was off this week. And in fairness, Kelly, those greens, not the best greens. I was in a media show out of the property on Wednesday and just randomly happened to be sitting next to a gentleman who was Alex Noren's caddy. Also happened to be Charlie Hull's swing coach. We were chatting a little bit and I was asking him, I was just asking him about the course. And he told me on Wednesday, the greens were really not good, that the balls were weaving around a bit. And, you know, I mean, I think they get a little bumpy. I think part of that element too, was because the USGA, you know, was trying to keep the place playable with 156 players to get through, you know, the first 2 days and significant wins in the forecast for Thursday. I don't think they were rolling or cutting them. You know, if they were cutting them, they weren't cutting them very low. And I'm sure they weren't rolling them. So I think that may, and plus they get chewed up as the week goes on. And Scotty was playing late on both rounds on Saturday and Sunday. But I think that, you know, in fairness to him, yes, he didn't putt that well, but they weren't, you know, they weren't the greatest of greens, but as I say that, I'm thinking about those great par putt saves that Wyndham made all week, and Sam Burns, for that matter, who led the entire field in scrambling and in one putts. So, but yeah, Scotty, he just was a little bit off. I mean, but I think what's most remarkable about what we're talking about with Scotty, and you just referenced it in your intro of this kind of the topic, that he's not keeping up with his wins from last year. We won like seven times last year.
Yeah, exactly.
Seven times is Tiger. So I think that's a little part of the problem, is the expectation level is, you know, he's raised the bar so much now that anything less is considered failure. But that said, Scotty hasn't been all right this year. I mean, he's had an issue with slow starts at golf tournaments. And he, you know, he shot 72 to open the tournament on Thursday. You know, so he's right out of the box, he's two over, you know. So, and, you know, and again, at a U.S. Open, two over is not terrible. But the point is, you know, it was, you know, leading into yesterday was the worst score he had shot in the first three rounds. So, yeah, I know it sounds like a little bit of a flip answer, but I also sometimes say, you know, because, you know, I think of the same thing with Rory. It's golf. You know, I mean, I don't care how good you are, you're not going to have your A game every week. And, you know, guys like Rory and Scotty are looked upon a little bit like, well, what's wrong with you? You didn't win this week. As I'm talking to you about this, it brings me to a conversation I had with J.J. Spaun, the defending champion. I went down to Doral back in March to do some advance work for this U.S. Open. And I walked a few holes with JJ and was talking about what, you know, what that win, U.S. Open win, meant to him and all. Because he had a great year last year. Obviously, he lost to Rory in a playoff at Players. And you know, JJ had a really interesting perspective. He was like, you know, he goes, I used to be able to turn up at a tournament. Nobody knew who I was. They didn't care what I was going to score. They expected me to miss the cut. Now I'm a US Open champion. I can't hide. You know, now it's like, you know, if I'm not playing, people want to know what's wrong. Well, Scotty has that 20-fold, right? To everybody else, sure, other than maybe Rory. So yeah, I don't look at it as a terrible week for Scotty. I just look at it as a week he just didn't have his A game. He hasn't had it more often than not, probably this year. Certainly, I mean, but his last two years have been ridiculous. He's won 13 or 14 times in the last 2 years. So I have little doubt that he is going to win a U.S. Open. It's weird to me, actually, of all of the majors, I feel like their U.S. Open is the one that suits him the best because he's so steady and he's such a great ball striker. But the fact that my end take, and I'll leave it on this, is the fact that Scotty was in the final pairing on Sunday on a week when he didn't have his stuff and he didn't make any putts just shows how ridiculously good and how much of a grinder he is, and just his ability to just stay there and be a factor. I mean, you know, he wasn't playing well in the front nine yesterday, nor was Wyndham, but he was still right there making the turn. He could have won that golf tournament on the back nine, but he just couldn't get it going.
You know, Mark, this has been such a good conversation. I'll tell you what, let's take a quick break to hear from our good friends at William & Harry Golf, then we'll come right back to continue our interview. Our friends at William & Harry are always looking for ways to stand out in the crowd. So for anyone who belongs to a country club, William & Harry can have your shoes private labeled to fit your specific needs. The same applies to your company or any organization you might be affiliated with. This makes you a clear winner. Why? Well, you have a better quality shoe that feels great, and you have the logo of your club, company, or organization on your shoes that really makes you stand out on the golf course. To learn more, visit williamandharry.com today and be sure to input our promotional code 15OFF, M-O-G, for a 15% discount at williamandharry.com.
Mark Cannizzaro, the terrific golf writer for the New York Post, joining us here on Musings on Golf as we recap the 126th U.S. Open at Shinnecock Hills. So, Mark, talk just a little bit about the golf course itself. You mentioned about the greens. We were lucky enough to have John Bodenhamer on last week leading into the U.S. Open here on Musings on Golf. And John said that the USGA, he felt, had learned some lessons from 2004 and 2018, when they weren't exactly shining stars for the USGA on the two previous Opens played at Shinnecock Hills. How do you grade the performance, the effort, if you will, of the USGA? Did they match the expectations going in terms of keeping the golf course playable and not having a bad mark, if you will, coming out?
I thought they did a fantastic job, and I was at the media day on May 5th. And John spoke and you know, said the same things that he said to you last week. They were very transparent about the fact that they had become the story for all the wrong reasons in 04 and in 18, you know, a little over the top, you know, lost the seventh green and back in 04, literally had to stop play and water it, which pissed off a lot of players because guys like Craig Stadler just walked off that hole with a big number. And then the next thing you know, the next group's got a nice wet receptive green. So that was an embarrassment. They lost the entire golf course essentially in 13. They didn't forecast the weather. I mean, the wind well enough on the Saturday, it became much more windy, you know, for the green speeds. It just wasn't doable. And obviously you had the Phil Mickelson incident, you know, playing hockey with his moving ball on 13, you know, clearly a message to the USGA on his part. So from the start, in my opinion, Kelly, you know, John has been, and the entire USGA group has been transparent about how much they learned those last two times around at Shinnecock, how much they've learned and realized that this course dries up faster than any they've ever dealt with. And the fact that they were going to ease the course into the week, that was really the theme of what I heard back on May 5th. We're not going to have it at U.S. Open condition at 6:45 on Thursday morning when the tournament starts, you know, or even on Wednesday, the day before. We're going to ease the way into the week. And this week, the weather in some ways forced them to do so, because It was going to be windy on Thursday. That was the windiest day out of all four. Although there was some decent wind on Saturday, but briefly, but it was not nearly as sustained and as it was on Thursday. So, I mean, they literally set that course up as easy as it could possibly set it up on Thursday. Pins in the middle of greens, they moved some tee box up. And even then, you didn't have guys ripping it up. The only really outlandish score the whole week was Wyndham Clark's 6 under on Thursday. And that was because the wind died down by the end of
Yes.
the day and he was a late tee time. So he was the beneficiary of that. And Dustin Johnson and Gary Woodland, I think they're all three of the same group, if I'm not mistaken. They were all like, I mean, Wyndham was 6. At one point, DJ was 4. And,
It was.
I think Gary was up there too. They gave a couple back. But, when you look at it at the end of the day, and here's the other thing that's cool about the transparency too, which I missed. After the rounds, after the cut was made on Friday, the USGA texted every one of the players that was in the field for the weekend and basically said, expect a firmer course starting Saturday. We're gonna rat, it's gonna be firmer. We're gonna ratchet the greens up. They had been at about 10, 10 and a half and the stimp on Thursday and Friday. They said they're gonna go up to about 11, 11 and a half on the weekend. So they didn't ambush the players with that on Saturday. There was no, I remember back, and I'm rambling, I'm gonna stop, but the 2012 US Open, if you remember, at Olympic Club, there was a lot of controversy because they moved that, I want to say it's the 17th tee, they moved it like 100 yards up or something like that, or I can't remember the exact, and I mean it really screwed the players up. It was like kind of, it was an ambush to some degree, and really, not needed to be done, or at least let the players know. These guys let everybody know what was going on all week this week, right through, certainly Friday night. And so as somebody who's been very critical of USGA in print and on radio and TV, for mistakes in the past, I stand up and praise the entire organization for the job they did this week. It was a great tournament. I mean, 4 under par is a proper winning score. It just in my, this is no nothing official, but in my mind, I feel like anything between 4 and 10 under par to win a golf tournament is kind of ideal. And you were at the PGA for a long time, and quite frankly, I always kind of, that was one of my favorite majors because they let the players play a little bit, but it didn't get stupid, right? And so the number was always somewhere between 4, 6, 8, 10, maybe a 12 here and there. Nobody was shooting, 22 under, unless there was an anomaly, and nobody was, suffocating and suffering at 1 over, if you will. So I thought that, the USGA touched all the right notes this week, and hopefully that'll carry on.
And I echo those thoughts, and I think that's very important. I know from my years at the PGA of America that the relationship that key players at the PGA formed with tour players was and continues to be critical to the success of the PGA Championship. Same thing here. For the USGA to send out that notification to the 70 plus players who made the cut, letting them know here's what's coming. Man, to me that's a it's a sign to me of respect from the USGA to the players, and I think ultimately that's a respect coming back to the players to that organization.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, listen, you had and still have Kerry Haig as your course setup guy, who was probably the best guy that's ever done that in the history of golf kind, right? So, I mean, I don't recall anybody ever criticizing any setup at a PGA Championship by Kerry Haig.
No.
So, you almost wish he was setting all of them up. He's so good. So, but listen, the USGA did a Kerry Haig job this week.
It really did.
That's a high compliment.
Hey, Mark, let's switch gears just a little bit. Before you became the lead golf writer, fully for the New York Post, you spent many years covering the New York Jets. 1993 to 2010, and you've continued on as a columnist covering the Jets, the Giants, soccer, and so forth. Covering the Jets that th then, and I would imagine even now, being the beat writer is an interesting responsibility, Mark Cannizzaro.
Well, Kelly, I was having a good morning until you had to bring up the jet coverage now. I mean, geez.
Right? I
Yeah,
know.
everybody I meet, they say, "Oh, I'm a big Jet fan." I'm like, "Oh, I'm so sorry." Listen, I've covered a lot of losing,
Huh?
but I think my favorite period of time covering the Jets, in a weird way as a sports writer, sometimes a lot of losing, like calamitous losing, like Rich Kotite era losing, is actually amazing to write because it is so over the top. And as a reporter, you find people that want to talk, you know, and aren't afraid to say things and tell it like it really is behind the scenes. And I think fans eat that stuff up, you know, in positive and negative ways, you know, I mean, you know, in times, if you will. But my favorite, you know, my favorite period was when Parcells came there, when they hired Bill Parcells, you know, after the 1996 disastrous second Kotite season. Yeah. And he just changed the entire culture of that place. And, you know, he had a good handful of players that had been on the losing Jet teams for years and years that I covered and, you know, and made built relationships with. And when those guys were making that run to the AFC Championship game in 1998, in Denver, being in that locker room and seeing the look on those players' faces who had just been beaten down by the losing, and all of a sudden now, you know, they're in the limelight of a great run in the postseason with a chance to go to a Super Bowl. I still remember all those names and faces, and I really enjoyed. Obviously, it's more fun covering winning teams because, you know, it's good for business too. I mean, you know, you want your readers. You know, readers are more inclined to read, you know, the successful team than the crappy team, right? So, I think that was my favorite period of time, without question. I mean, they. Unfortunately, you know, they kind of threw that Denver game away in 98. They really should have been by all. I mean, they fumbled. Every one of Parcells' most dependable key players, I think, fumbled in that game in Denver, which is a brutally cold day and a windy day. But so they didn't get to that Super Bowl, which was too bad. And I don't think I've ever seen Parcells look more ashen than I did when he was sitting in the front seat of the team bus to leave Denver that day. But the fact that they got to that place was pretty cool. The Rex Ryan years, pretty cool, pretty fun. Because talk about instant copy for us. And, you know, listen, he brought that team to two consecutive AFC championship games as well with Mark Sanchez, who's really one of my favorite people that I've covered with the Jets, who really gets a bad rap from the Jets fans. Cause I mean, this is a guy that's their most successful postseason quarterback in history, you know, other than Namath, who won the Super Bowl, but Namath's record wasn't even as good on the, you know, in postseason as Mark's was. But so those are my fun, you know, best memories. I mean, there's a lot of calamitous times, you know, that they were so bad, they didn't seem real. So there was that made for some good writing as well, you know, and I want so badly for the Jet fan to have a Super Bowl again. I mean, most of them that are still alive now, you know, don't, you know, they weren't even around, you know, in 69, you know, and if they were, you know, they've waited a long time for another one. So, you know, we'll see what happens. You know, as I said, I actually had a nice little brief conversation with Darren Moji on the putting green yesterday. I told him, I said, shouldn't you be inside someplace making a trade or something like that? Because he's been a very active general manager. He has.
Yes, he has.
Yeah. So, we, you know, we'll see how it goes. They got a lot of improvements to make. I'm not really I'm not a huge believer in Geno Smith, you know, who they obviously brought in to be quarterback, but we'll see. You know, I have my doubts. You know, at the bottom line is, you know, no team, I don't care if Vince Lombardi's coaching them, is going to win without a quarterback. And that, quite frankly, has been the Jets' biggest problem for most of the years that I've covered them.
A couple more questions left for Mark Cannizzaro, the longtime and excellent golf writer for the New York Post here on Musings on Golf. Mark, you played two sports at Ithaca College back in the day, right? You played both what, tennis and soccer?
I did.
Were you were you obviously a good athlete growing up?
I've always been a junkie, you know, a sports junkie, and I played everything sport wise. You know, when I was a kid, I was, you know, I mean, I was out in the, you know, in the neighborhoods playing, you know, tackle football, you know, every day, you know, and frisbee football, you name it, whatever it was. Tennis was always my best sport because I was not lucky enough to live in an area where I get to play, you know, tennis pretty much every day as a kid. And I was a way better tennis player than a soccer player. I like to tell people that I was on the soccer team as opposed to that I played on the soccer team, even though I did play a bit, but I certainly would not, profess myself to be some great soccer player, but I actually was a fairly decent tennis player back in the day, and I still play a little bit now as much as I can because I love it. And but it's weird. I wasn't a golfer when I was a kid. I didn't take up golf really with any relative any seriousness until I started working at the Post and started covering golf. And now, of course, I can't get enough of it. I've got the problem. If I could play 6 times a week, I would. But yeah, no, I Ithaca was also a great place to go because it was, I wasn't an elite athlete, so Division III, was a place that I would be able to actually play, a sport. I wasn't going to go to University of Miami or something like that and play D1 tennis. I was never going to be that good. I wished I would be, but I wasn't. So.
Mark, two final questions. You mentioned soccer. You're heading out. We're recording this interview at roughly noon Eastern time on Monday, the day after the U.S. Open. And you're heading out soon to Los Angeles to cover the U.S. Men's soccer team at the World Cup. Pretty exciting stuff, huh?
Yes, I'm very fired up for it. And as we referred, I've always loved soccer, and I love covering soccer. I love watching it and playing it. The U.S. has looked so good in this first two group matches. Quite frankly, Kelly, if it hadn't conflicted with the U.S. Open, I would have covered their first two matches in the group. But obviously, U.S. Open takes precedence for us. So I will be there for. I'll be covering the Thursday match against Turkey, which now is kind of an odd match because they don't really need it to advance themselves. And they already won. They've already clinched the group. And then I'll move on with them. To San Francisco, where they'll play, where the 49ers play at Levi's Stadium, which I guess is now called San Francisco Stadium because they renamed all. FIFA has everything renamed.
Bring up those logos, right?
Yeah, it's just ridiculous. I mean, it's don't get me going on that. That's a whole nother podcast. So I'll be there. I'll be with them right through. As far as they go, which is going to be a lot of fun. It's a little weird. I'm leaving. I got a 6 a.m. flight tomorrow, and I got to pack today. And I don't really know what I'm packing for. I don't know if I'm packing for a week or 3 weeks. So we'll see. But I do have the British Open on the other side of that. So I'm also in a weird spot where if they get to the quarterfinals, I might not be able to cover the quarterfinal match because I got to go. I'm heading to England for the British. So we'll see. I mean, it's a good problem to have because the further the deeper they would be able to, if they are able to get deep into this tournament. It will be pretty remarkable and a pretty crazy good story because, obviously we're not known as a soccer nation.
Rob, let's close with this final question. Typically, I ask my guests, who would round out a dream foursome for you? And I just want to take a little different take on that, Mark, if I may. And you have covered 35 U.S. Opens, and you have covered more than 120 major golf championships. So you've seen a shot or two in your day. How about for Mark Cannizzaro, of the 35 U.S. Opens you covered, anybody top three or four that stand out for whatever reason?
Well, it's hard not to think about 2000 and Tiger at Pebble, because of how he dominated, because it was at Pebble. I believe that was also Jack's last competitive U.S. Open. I might not be mistaken, and I'll never forget him going for 18 and two that day, and I believe he trickled one up close. And so that is seared in my memory forever. That's a hard one to forget. And you have to throw Torrey Pines in there at 08 just because the drama of that, with the injury, making that putt at the end, to force the playoff and then the playoff with Rocco. And I actually also on a personal level was I was in the throes of I had been battling stage 4 melanoma during that period of time, and I was in full chemo mode at that point, and was feeling pretty, I mean, not very well physically. But my biggest thing when I had the cancer was I did not want to sit around and not work and dwell about it. I dwell on things. I wanted to just carry on and keep my routine, which meant keep working, which I love to do. And so I do remember that was a very difficult week for me. And I kind of in a weird way, I mean, listen, I don't want to disparage Tiger, but Tiger can be a little dramatic You know, I mean, we can use the word drama queen sometimes with Tiger. You know, that he's the only person that's ever, you know, had this ailment, or he's the first person ever had a child, or whatever. I'm just, you know, and I'm not saying that because I dislike Tiger, but we, you know, I've covered him forever, and I felt in the latter years, as Tiger's talked about, you know, having the broken leg, which was a stress fracture in his leg or whatever, and the knee injury. You know, and still, I'm not taking anything away from the win because it was remarkable. But I thought to myself, if he felt a fraction of as bad as I felt that week, he wouldn't have made the cut. So, I mean, you know, I had a little bit, you know, and I'm not trying to better him or one up. I'm just saying, I remember that week for a lot of reasons, and I remember having a difficult time that week just getting to the golf course, for a number of reasons, and I was really. I walk. I like to. I'm a walker on the course. I like to follow the groups, which I did yesterday, and I walked, you know, all every single hole with Tiger and Rocco on that final round on the Sunday. So I do remember that, you know, for a lot. I'll remember forever Wingfoot and Phil not getting it done. Yeah, you know, that was a hard one because I'm a big Phil proponent. He's been very good to me over the years. Particularly, quite frankly, when I was sick. I mean, he was instrumental in terms of my psyche and whatnot, by reaching out to me when I was ill, reaching out to me. I was in the hospital for 3 months. He was checking in on me almost every other day. And so I, you know, as I said before, you root for good stories, and you know, sometimes you root for the people you like. And I was rooting for both of those at that U.S. Open. At Wingfoot, and you know, the way he handled it afterwards, you know, I'll never forget the quote. He stood in front of the media and he said, "I am such an idiot." I'll never forget. That was the quote. You know, I mean, you know, so and you know, obviously that he's, you know, he needed that U.S. Open for a Grand Slam completion, and he never got it, and he's not going to get it either, obviously. So I'll remember that for a long, long time. There's a lot of other little mini memories, you know. When Michael Campbell won at Pinehurst,
Yeah, sure.
I remember being down in the locker room, you know, to try to maybe pick off a player or two to talk about Michael or whatever. And obviously Tiger had just finished, I think right around the time Michael finished. And while I was down there, Tiger's caddy, Steve Williams, who was never a fan of the media, or, you know, wouldn't any Mr. Nice Guy awards, even though he is a really good guy. But, you know, he was like Tiger's bodyguard basically back in the day. And I'll never forget Steve Williams in a quiet moment down there. You know, he's from New Zealand, as is Michael. And him congratulating Michael down in that locker room was, you know, in the quiet of that locker room. I don't think there was more than five people in there. I just happened to have gone down there, and I remember Michael Campbell using an actual landline telephone to call his parents in New Zealand to tell him that he won the New Zealand, you know, that he won the U.S. Open. So that's kind of a little hidden cool memory. I mean, there's a million of them, obviously, but that's right up there. And I would also say Phil, when he didn't get it done, when he was over, you know, when Lucas Glover won at Bethpage, Phil had it going that day, and he just got a
Oh,
couple
he
back
did.
late. I mean, he got a really terrible break, or late there. I want to say on 15, just over the back of the green or something like that, and maybe I'm at 17 too. But I will never forget walking around the backside of Bethpage an hour after it was all over, and Phil was out there signing autographs to, there must have been 50 or 60 people out there, and
Wow.
he spent probably 45 minutes signing autographs after a devastating loss, you know. And you know, people like their criticism of Phil, whatever. You know, I you know, it seems like he's made some sort of mistake. I mean, he made a bad decision maybe at the, you know, his name's in the news right now for, you know, a sexual harassment situation or whatever. You know, I go by the way people treat me, but I also go by the way I see them operate behind the closed doors when people aren't watching.
Yes.
You know, Mike Tannenbaum, the Jets general manager for years, always had a, he used to judge people. He'd be in a taxi cab with a player or something like that, you know, or you know, going from one place to the other, and he would always judge people. You know, he would see the way somebody treated a cabbie, if you will. I know that's not, and I look at that like, you know, the things that people like Phil, and Phil's certainly not the only one, but the thing that these athletes do behind, you know, where there's no camera in front of them. A million of these players are signing autographs when the cameras are out there showing them doing it. But when I saw him out there for an extended period of time on his way to his car, signing 50, 60 autographs, maybe more, I'm like, you know, that's pretty cool. So yeah, I could turn this podcast into a, you know, 3 hours, you know, cause there's a lot of great memories of, yeah. But those are some cool ones.
Mark Cannizzaro, cannot thank you enough for the great storytelling in this, the time we spent, the great storytelling that you've weaved over the years with the New York Post. And you're ready, as you said, you're ready for more, man. You're ready to get on that plane and go to Los Angeles. You're ready to go to Royal Birkdale to see who wins that fourth major of 2026. The games just keep coming, man. It's and as long as you still love what you're doing, Mark, then that's where you got to go, right?
Absolutely. I look forward to all of it. I kind of get a little flack because I want to do everything. You know, I am a massive FOMO guy. I mean, I'm a serious fear of missing out guy. My wife rats me about it all the time. I want to be everywhere doing everything. I was actually bummed I didn't do the U.S. Paraguay match, which was like a day before I had to go out to Shinnecock. And my office is like, no, go to Shinnecock. You go to the third match. You know, you're not flying out to California for a match and then coming back and then the next day being in the car from Shinnecock. So, yeah, I do. I do like it. My wife always says to me, you know, when do you want to retire? And I always say, you know, when they stop sending me to the British Open and the Masters and Super Bowls and World Cups and things like that. So that's been a bit my mantra, you know.
Absolutely. Hey, safe travels, my friend. This has been terrific. And we look forward to reading a lot more from Mark Cannizzaro down the line.
Thanks, Kelly. Thanks for having me.
I really hope you enjoyed hearing from Mark Cannizzaro as much as I did interviewing him. A lot to unwrap from the 126th United States Open Golf Championship, that's for sure. Next week, we will delve deep into the business of golf and sports with Rick Haro, the sports professor. Had the interview already with Rick, and talk about an insightful guy. You're going to have a lot of fun hearing from Rick next week. Thank you again for joining us. For Jenna Self, the Dean of Production, Kelly Elbin signing off, and thanking you for joining us on Musings on Golf.